Big Black and kind of as a person, because we met him socially from at a wedding that we played out in Chicago, and there was sort of a Windsor connection because the guy who was his roommate and who introduced us to him was from Windsor and had bought some of our singles when we were playing in Windsor one time.
Oh, wow. do you remember that guy's name? We might know him.
Yeah, Dave Vicelli. He's also known as Botch, who runs one of the biggest booking agents in the States.
Oh, yes.
Now. The Billions Corporation.
Yes, that's okay. I think we touched on that briefly last time.
Yeah. So Botch was our booking agent. And then there were other people in Chicago, John Moore from the group Tar and Beck Dudley from the group Moto that we became friends with. So we went down to play at John and Beck's wedding. And there we met Steve and re-met Botch, who was now a booking agent, and many other people who would kind of make Chicago like, you know, one of our favorite places to play, and kind of like one of the first sort of cities in the U.S. That where we really had an audience. So no, Steve was great to work with. The third time that we recorded with him, which was the Sport Fishing album, I remember being kind of different, not only because of like the studio, but because Steve had just bought a car and was shopping for car stereos. So the entire time that we were recording, he was reading magazines about car stereos. And so, you know, we'd finish a take and ask him, like, how did that sound? And he would reply, well, I don't know. I haven't heard it yet because I still have to get this stereo installed in my car. And I don't know what that stereo sounds like. So he was, like, barely paying attention, which is kind of, like, his way sometimes. Sometimes he's fully present. I guess that's one of the things about Steve is that, you know, I've seen it time and time again when you read interviews with him or hear him speak, is that it's very much a job. He's very much, like, a worker. And sometimes he's paying attention to the art. Sometimes he's not. Sometimes he's just there as a sort of technician. And he was kind of both, because, you know, we're definitely friends with him and going out for meals and that with him. And, you know, he would come to see us play live. And so, yeah, we had a very good relationship, and it was really enjoyable working with him.
Now, I don't know if this is true. I've read this. It said that he recorded the album for free, or is that...
No, he didn't record it for free. But in our awareness of Steve, like even knowing who we are, was from an interview that he did in a magazine, I think it was Your Flesh magazine, in which he said that when they asked him about, like, you know, how he, what he charges bands, you know, like, because he's pretty famous for not taking like a percentage, like many engineers, producers do, you know, they'll want like points on your record. He does it that, you know, you get paid for the work and that's it. That's the end. And, you know, to this day, I still prefer that arrangement. If someone wants a percentage, I'm like, forget that, because it's like inevitably going to be like nothing. I'd rather just give you the $200 up front that you're going to get from royalties than deal with fucking accounting. So many people I know, so many bands I know, get into conflicts with people they've done work with like that years and years later because they have an obligation to provide accounting, and it's like, I hate doing taxes. I don't even want to do that. And that's like such a burden once a year. So like doing all that, like, you know, accounting, especially when you're not getting paid from your record company, as it happened with Cargo Records, who did that album. So, you know, it's like, oh yeah, we sold this many records, but a record company hasn't paid us. So, you know, therefore we would have been paying him. But we paid him what his going rate was. But in this magazine interview, they asked him what his rates were, and he said, I would charge Depeche Mode $1 million, but I would do Shadowy Men for free. And so, you know, people brought it to our attention, and we're like, whoa. But we definitely believe in paying people fairly and everybody getting paid. You know, that's something that we're...
That was just an interesting fact that came up because of the interview, and I always wondered about it.
No, we paid, but, you know, it was not super exorbitant. Oh, my God. I mean, I wish I had the receipts for how much we paid, because I remember at the time, like, going into a studio like Chicago Recording Company. So that studio was owned by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, you know, who, like, producers who had... I forget what band they were in before. Not long after Janet Jackson's Rhythm Nation, which was a huge, huge album. Mm-hmm. And the hallways were like lined with like platinum albums from records that they'd worked on. And it was a really spacious studio. Each of us was in our own room in this sort of like L-shaped studio. So it was like a cube, with the control room being in, you know, sort of like the negative space if it was an L. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Stephen there with windows into all three rooms. And so it was just like glass rooms. I was in a really large room with the drums, the biggest room. Brian was in like medium-sized room beside me with a grand piano that Steve had mic'd up and was using the sympathetic vibrations from the strings on the grand piano as a additional like room sort of reverb. And then Reed was in the room beyond that. So it was kind of like visually being in the same room with each other and, you know, had a much sort of bigger and punchier sound than what we were used to. So we definitely liked the kind of the bigger sound that we were getting on that record, because it was, to us, sort of closer to what we sound like live, you know?
Yeah.
And I know Steve is known for really capturing that live sound too on studio recordings, and like a lot of other producers or engineers. One thing I just want to touch upon in regards to the production again for the record, I've read a lot of interviews about Albini's production and engineering. As you've alluded to, sometimes he's very hands-off, and then other times he's more involved, such as recommending alternative tunings. I know infamously he told the Pixies to play with metal picks instead of the standard picks they were playing with. Did he present the band anything to work with during these recording sessions, or was it just completely you're left to the wiles, I'm pressing record and just perform?
It was pretty much like just perform. You know, he knew that we could play. You know, he'd seen us live a bunch of times, and I think he was more kind of like about getting out of our way, which in some ways is kind of a, you know, maybe more of an idea than a reality, because you hear the recording and it has like some very distinctive things about it that are very Steve. Like, you know, I'd done a bunch of home recording, and I remember like the drum sound, like there's something about like the sounds of his drums, particularly his snare drum. So, you know, I'm in this big room, there's like far mics, so you get like a microsecond of a delay, which just kind of like, you know, gives it a nice sort of reflection sound. But I could hear like something else going on, and I asked him, I said, do you have delay on the snare drum? And he said, no. And then I asked again later, I said, I'm sure I'm hearing delay. He said, no, how could you be hearing delay? There's no delay there. And then I asked again about it. And I think like the third time I asked, he said, yes, there is. And so I kind of like discovered that, oh, there's one of Steve's tricks, is like he puts like, you know, these like maybe one or two, sometimes three very short delays on drums, which just, you know, give you the sense of space, because it's sort of like the sound of the snare ricocheting off of surfaces, you know?
You're listening to Revolution Rock here on CJAM 99.1 FM, or perhaps listening to us on any of the stations that do syndicate our program. We do want to thank you for that. Coming back from that last block of music and from interviews, we heard quite a bit, as we're highlighting on this episode, all the great interviews conducted both on air and also via the website revrock.blogspot.com that were conducted throughout 2023. And one of my favorites of the year was definitely with Don Pyle. Such a sweet wonderful person to talk to. I really loved our candid conversation. Don graciously gave us so much time, and we really appreciated that. And also talking about this magnificent record, Sport Fishin'.
Yeah, their third album, Shadowy Man on a Shadowy Planet, produced by Steve Albini. And we actually played the whole album in full on the show. So we heard a short clip. Actually, we heard a song from the said album called Plastics for 500 Bob. And then we heard a clip from the interview with Don. And then we actually heard a pair of tracks from Shadowy Man on a Shadowy Planet from the same album.
That's right. We heard Peas, Porridge, Rock, and Relax, You Will Think You Are a Chicken. Before that, we heard a pair of tracks from an online interview that was conducted with Mono Negatives.
Yeah, based out of London, Ontario, kind of a synth punk band. We heard a pair of tracks from Crossing Visual Field. We heard Disappearing Architecture and Living in the Future. Prior to that, we heard a track from Ghost Woman from Anne If. They actually put out two albums in 2023, and we had a short email interview with Evan of the band.
That's right. So we heard the track Street Neat from Anne If, and that album, along with, I guess you could say, its sister album that was released later in the year, Hindsight is 50-50, did make our Best Albums of the Year list when we did two episodes of that. So you can also check that out on the website at revrock.blogspot.com. Prior to that, another unique interview that I didn't think was going to be managed, and yet Dave worked his magic, talking to Chris Jack of The Routes.
Yeah, in Japan, based in Japan. Originally, he's from the UK. He lives there, and they actually have started doing shows since we did that interview at the beginning of 2023, which is great. Chris Jack of The Routes, and he actually put out an album at the time he was still working on the mixes. This came out in 2023 called Reverberation Addict, and it's all surf versions of Buzzcocks songs, which is pretty great. They did one a few years back about Kraftwerk. They did all surf versions of Kraftwerk songs.
That's right. Now, this new album is fantastic. If you're a fan of surf music, if you're a fan of The Routes, or if you're a fan of Buzzcocks, you're sure to enjoy this. From Reverberation Addict, we heard their version of Fast Cars, that was preceded by a brief snippet of that interview with Chris Jack. Then we heard two other songs from The Routes. We heard In a Rut from Get Past Go.
That's an instrumental surf album that came out also in 2023. And another album that also came out from this band in 2023 was Leadline Clouds, which was a more garage psych-based album. We heard a song called Opinions. Prior to that, we heard music from By Divine Right. We heard a pair of tracks from Automato, which came out at the end of 2022. We heard It's Not Over and Eastside Anthem. In between that, we heard a short clip with Jose Contreras of the band. We spoke to him in February. And then we started off the show with I Climb demo, and this is a demo from the Automato demo that was released in 2023 digitally via Bandcamp. So we started off the show. We're going to continue next, dipping into some music and then an interview that was really a wonderful opportunity to get with Bri Webb.
Bri Webb, an amazing musician, arguably best known for the work with the Constantines, or I should just say Constantines.
Right, no the.
No the, but a fantastic artist who put on one heck of a show at a venue earlier this year in Windsor at the Dominion House.
Yeah.
Intimate, wonderful program, and so gracious again, sharing the time for this interview with us. So we're going to play a song called AM Blues, preceding a snippet of that interview, before getting into some more interview clips from 2023 here on Revolution Rock.
bones and moons.
There's been a gap between this album, Run With Me, and your last. What led up to this album being made?
So the biggest thing was I think I was just working a lot. I was working and I was a parent. And like 5-6 years ago, I just started to feel like I wasn't doing anything really well. I was passively doing a bunch of stuff and I was kind of overwhelmed and tired and just felt like I could maybe set music aside. And that be the thing that would cause the least damage if I stopped doing, you know? So, so that happened. And then, again, like the pandemic happened and things just seemed really up in the air and confusing. And I don't think anybody knew how we were going to make music, you know, in the future. And then, so there was this big gap. And I love my job and I really worked, like, I like what I do at CFRU, you know, working with people, sort of not, like, trying to take up a bit less space because I get, you know, I get to take up plenty of space for years and help other folks learn how to use the technology to express themselves and share their perspectives. And so that became more important and more of a focus, which is great. Especially through the pandemic when people were disconnected and alienated and isolated, it became more and more important to me. Then at the beginning of this year, I had a lot of personal change all of a sudden, and I won't go into the details of it, but it was created a situation where I just felt like I needed an outlet, and I started to sing again just for the act of singing, and I really started to love the physical feeling of singing again. I had forgotten that feeling. So I would just go into a little space in the backyard and sing and learn songs that I had written a long time ago, or, you know, just try and even learn Michael Hurley songs or, whatever, like just stuff that was enjoyable to sing. And that turned into writing some stuff again as an outlet. And then I started to sketch out and record little scratches of songs, and then I sent those to friends that I hadn't reached out to in years, from, you know, the last 25 years of making music, and everybody came through. People just added stuff at home. Some folks came to my place and recorded. Nate Lohr recorded drums. Nate, who's on like the Live at Massey record and was in the Providers for years, and Aaron Goldstein, Anna Ruddick, Tom Hamerton, Rich Burnett, and then like older friends like Julie Doiron and Daniel Romano. Most of the Cons play on the record, and a band that I had, like the first single that we put out is Thunder Bay, which was a recording of a band called the Harbor Coats that I had in Montreal in like 2009. That band, like, that was the earlier versions of a lot of the songs on the other records, like Rivers of Gold and Translator and Positive People and stuff. The original versions of those were done with the Harbor Coats, so this was sort of a real reaching back, and they all were really supportive and let me use that recording. Yeah, so it's been a kind of reaching out, you know, and it's turned out really lovely. I'm not a person that was very good at asking for help in a lot of situations, especially in kind of tougher times, and it has been an exercise in that, you know, and people really coming through.
So you're talking about the first single, Thunder Bay. So like, you recorded that back in 2009, and did you kind of add to it, or?
It's almost entirely as it was then, but I redid the vocal because it just didn't I just wanted it to sound closer to what the rest of the record sounded like, so I redid the lead vocal for it, and that's it. But yeah, it's all the original folks from the Harbor Coats on it otherwise.
Was this like the first song where you're like, okay, I have, like, was there a song in particular when you were coming up with stuff where you're like, okay, I think I have something here, it's time to, let's work on this album?
There were two things kind of happened that around the same time. One was that I was staying at a friend's place and didn't have any instruments with me, and my friends Jenny Mitchell, like Bird City, Jenny Mitchell and Jenny Omnicord, and her partner Scott Haynes, who's a shopkeeper and like does great guitar repair work in town here, they lent me like this scrappy little parlor guitar, and I had it at my friend's place that I was staying at, and I ended up writing the song called Ask Me Everything, which was the first new song I'd written in 6 years or so, five, six years, and that happened, and I think the same week I found this like cache of like this on like a hard drive, these like demos from 5+ years ago, things that I had just thought I lost, that I didn't like, I just hadn't thought about, and then most of those ended up on the record in different versions. Well, you haven't heard the record yet, but
no, just the one.
there's a song called What I Do that's from like 6.5-7 years ago. A song called Outbound Only No Return that was like a kind of garage rock song that the Providers did for a little while. And yeah, anyway, so that both of those things happened, and suddenly it was like, oh, maybe there's stuff here that I could start to work on and make something out of. And then it just became a project that I really like needed at the time, you know, just going through the winter and a bunch of changes, and having something to work on was really good for me.
You touched on a little bit about the different contributions, and what would you say was the most like, or maybe one of the most unexpected things where you're like, oh wow, I didn't expect this. I got to use this.
I think my favorite was Daniel Romano.
Okay.
Where he's on Outbound Only No Return, and it's kind of like a J.J. Cale style, like, driving song, you know, like, and I sent it to him, like, as we had it at that stage, it was mostly complete, and I just asked him to, like, add whatever he wanted to it, and I didn't know if he was going to play guitar on it, or sing, or whatever, and I got back this, like, 8 tracks of layered vocals that sounded like Fleetwood Mac or like Freddie Mercury or something. Like it was this incredible like backing vocal stuff that just like when Jeff McMurrick and I, Jeff who runs is one half of VD Fix Records, put out the record, but also has been the engineer and producer I've worked with since Tournament of Hearts, the Cons, like he recorded that record. And so he and I brought it up, like, and you know, dropped it into the actual song, and just like howl laughing, like just tears. It was just so amazing and absurd and just beyond what I would have ever done myself. That was one of my favorite moments of making the record, for sure. It was just such a delight, such a Daniel moment.
So we talked a little bit about how we came up with some of the stuff, and I wanted to ask, like, how would you compare? I know there's a difference between the two, but like, how would you compare maybe the recording experience of this album as opposed to Provider, your first one?
Provider was really different because it was pretty much live off the floor. We like had a really simple like band of, it was Mike Brooks on pedal steel, Tyler Belews on upright bass, Rich Burnett on lap steel, and Rich has been my kind of right hand man forever, and then myself. And we just set up at 6 Nassau, which was Jeff McMurrick's studio in Toronto, and we're live, like, pretty much that whole record, which was great. That was a really, like, eye-opening way to make, because I, again, had had a gap in, like, making records before that, and had burnt out on kind of studio, like, spending too much time in a studio and just feeling wasteful. And so Provider was, this more stripped-down live simple, which I value, and I'd like to get back to doing something more like that again, but this record felt more like collage work. Like, it was like there were ideas for songs that weren't even like fully realized when I started sending them to people, and then I would get stuff back and that would change kind of the shape of where things went. I would go to like Tom Hamerton's backyard studio, and we would just sit there and like arrange horns, or like he would play his acoustic piano And I would just sit there and like be amazed at what he was doing. And I just got these like both remote and like in-person reconnections with people. But again, it felt like piecemeal, which would have psyched me out in the past, but it was just the way it had to happen this time around. It was kind of, and people have gotten so good at that. I think maybe like even 10 years ago, people were just learning to, you know, record in bits and pieces and perform well and not overthink it and not overproduce themselves in those moments. And now like everyone is so good. Everyone works so much like that. It's really wild. I would still love to record like a live thing more again, but it just couldn't be that way with this record. It was more like, yeah, sending postcards back and forth with friends.
You talked about Jeff McMurray already a bit, but did he work with you on this record as well?
Yeah, although like usually we would work together in a studio, you know, from the beginning of the recording to the end and the mixing, but this time he just, I have the best label situation like anyone could ask for. Like I didn't do anything, a new studio record for 9 years. And then I like kind of started, like Jeff was checking in on me just a little bit on a personal level. And I was like, I think I might start recording some stuff. And he's like, okay. And then just left me kind of alone and like to do it. And then we started, more and more I would be like, well, it might actually happen. Like, do you think we could talk about releasing this? And we had like one meeting with Alex Durlach and Jeff and I, and give me a deadline, you know? And they said like, I think it was end of May or maybe even the beginning of May or something. Mm-hmm. And so it was really like maybe 6 weeks to 2 months of just that, of the recording. And then I gave it to them and they were like, okay, we can do it and we can put it out by November. And which is almost unheard of now, like to finish a record in May and have it out by November is absurd. And they just did it in this, and it was so supportive, no pressure, and then just stoked. And like when I got back, when I sent Jeff the unmixed but pretty much finished like recordings of the songs in the order that I had imagined them being for the record, he just sent back a text that said, I effing love this record. it was like the most, because I had no idea. It was like one of the most like vulnerable moments is like sending it out to the first person, especially the person where you're hoping will put some money into releasing it. And it was just the most lovely, exactly what I needed at the moment. So yeah, and I love that label. I think they do really interesting things.
Full time, tell truth, say what